Hi, I'm Kristen.
And I'm her little brother, William.
We're from the podcast Guide to the Unknown, where we only talk about scary stuff and have a good time doing it.
Come join the scary fun, everyone.
Wherever you get your podcasts, you'll find Guide to the Unknown.
Welcome to this week's episode of Safe Room, a horror video game podcast and proud member of Bloody Disgusting's Bloody FM podcast network. I'm your host, Jay Krieger.
And I'm the other one, Neil Bolt.
And this week, we're heading back to the bayou to investigate the survival horror stomping grounds of the Dorsetto Mansion in Pieces Interactive's Alone in the Dark reboot. This seventh installment in the Alone in the Dark series is a reimagining of the original, starring Hollywood talents such as Jodie Comer as Emily Hartwood and David Harbour as Detective Edward Cardenby, who travel to the Dorsetto Mansion in hopes of uncovering the disappearance of Emily's uncle, Jeremy Hartwood. So last month, Neil, we covered the original Alone in the Dark and were fairly surprised by how well its survival horror design has withstood the test of time in the 30 plus years since its release. Now after finally getting our hands on this long awaited reboot, I'm curious, what was your sort of impression of the opening hour of Alone in the Dark? Because I think, through talking about the original and then, our general hype for the idea of like a reboot that this time around seemed to be a little bit more in line with what we've kind of expected from other horror reboots and remakes over the last, 10 years or so. I think I would say for myself, like this is one of the reboots that I was probably more excited for just because of the fact that I didn't have that same deep rooted love of the Alone in the Dark brand. And so, the potential for this new horror sort of love to flourish in a new way was incredibly exciting for me. So for you, how was that opening hour for you?
There are elements where you could tell where it had pulled from, for instance, in terms of like the perspective, certain ideas in terms of like the shifting between places and stuff like that. Whereas, a little rickety, going into it with the thought of it not being like, it's not a Capcom remake, it's not that kind of level of thing. And it's not going to be a Sony-backed thing like the Silent Hill 2 remake will be. So always expecting rough edges, that was fine. And once you get into the groove of that, I think it's quite cool. I quite liked the slow build, the slow atmosphere. The sense that you're not quite sure what's going on next, even having played like the original, which it copies quite a lot of the beats from, and it's very faithful in a lot of ways that some remakes aren't, from the ones we've been talking about. And I was just really digging the atmosphere of it all, like that. It was, that soundtrack was coming in, and that was one of the things I was really excited about going in. This doom jazz soundtrack is just phenomenal in my ear, I should say. And obviously you're learning little bits and pieces, and we know most of the story beats from having played the other one recently. But I felt it was a strong opening in terms of like setting the tone, the pace, the style. It just had a few quirks and kinks here and there, I think, in terms of like trying to settle into what it wanted to be. Which I think do emerge here and there as we go on from here.
Yeah, for me, it was the thing where I definitely could see the structure, the framework, right, of like leading players into a world that, a majority of people are probably not all that well-versed in, right, Alone in the Dark franchise. But even for people like us that, have played bits and bobs of the series and, obviously more frequently or recently we've played the original, like it was a great first impression that there were certain variables that I was familiar with or that I recognized, but at the same time, it didn't feel like it was following the exact script of the original game, in that the pacing and the exploration aspect of it, you get to see a little bit more of the mechanics behind, obviously this is a third person over the shoulder approach rather than the traditional fixed camera perspective. But also you get to see, the inventory system, which plays into more than just, equipping weapons, but more importantly, various clues that you'll collect, notes, and then these little almost like memorabilias that you'll find that once you collect a certain amount of them in a given set, they either will reveal something about the world in greater depth or will reveal like a key item or something like that. And so from that aspect, it was nice to see, okay, while I can identify the influences for a lot of these mechanics and whatnot, at the end of the day, though, it was presenting something that was not as black and white in terms of continuing alone in the dark, which is what I sort of expected a little bit more, and just kind of like following the exact beat of the original game. So to see them draw influences and use variables from that, but slightly shifting the order and pacing of things, was something that, you know, I was keen on. And I think overall, you know, I thought this game for the most part was pretty gorgeous, but it continued what I really liked from the prologue that we played earlier last year, or later last year. And that was a sense of atmosphere, the sense of the Dracetto Mansion, filling it with people. You know, typically in these games, when you show up to a place, everybody's dead. So it was nice to see like a cast be introduced, people that were actually like involved in this mystery that you were getting these little snippets of. There's some very eccentric personalities, but more importantly, you know, that environment of the mansion itself, getting to see this sort of Victorian almost era, or like plantation style rather, house that you're going to investigate. And it, you know, it abides by some of the normal constructs of architecture, but then very quickly becomes apparent that, oh, there's this Lovecraftian angle that bleeds into the world in a way that you might be able to see coming. But at the same time, I'm kind of a sucker for that Layers of Fear influence, where it's like, oh, I'm going to return to this area, now it's completely different. But I think in that regard, Alone in the Dark does it in a way that's more interesting than just, okay, now there was a door here, there's no door there anymore. It's a little bit more in depth than that, in the ways in which it ties into the narrative and the history of this setting and whatnot. So I guess my next question for you would be, and it's kind of a broad one, and we'll get into, you know, all of the specifics and nitty gritties of the Alone in the Dark reboot. But for me, I'm most curious for you, like, has Alone in the Dark learned worthwhile lessons from numerous other successful reboots, you know, in the last 16 years since they previously tried to reboot Alone in the Dark, which, as we know, was not the roaring success that they thought it would be?
Well, I mean, if you're going to quantify success as anything, it surpassed the sales of that game. So already, so that's good straight away out of the game. I mean, that's what you want. So, yeah, modest success financially, that's always a good stepping stone. In terms of like structure and, you know, what we had with horror games, I think having, you know, Mikael Hedberg's involvement here, you know, is important. I think in terms of leading the story forward and like really fleshing out, you know, one of the stronger elements, as we were talking about with Alone in the Dark, is it has, you know, an interesting story at its core. This really pushes it further. The games, it really reminds me of the most, aren't necessarily horror, but they have dabbled in horror, is Frogwares stuff, you know, the Sherlock Holmes games, and their very own Lovecraftian game, The Sinking City. And in fact, their most recent Sherlock Holmes game, which sort of dealt with more occult sort of stuff. Where again, where you expect a certain level of, you know, technical trickery to try and cover the paper over the cracks, but there's a depth there that maybe isn't there in certain others. Now, herein is where I think it learns a lesson better from there than it does from trying to be more like Resident Evil, for instance, is sticking to its focus on being very puzzle heavy and making sure that combat is secondary, even though it's there. Because I think that creates a tension that stopped being there, I think, with Resident Evil remakes, for instance, where it always kind of felt like it had a bit too much ammo and it was very obvious where you could avoid things. And here it feels a bit more unpredictable, especially in the way that you are thrown into places out of nowhere, you know, alien to where you were 5 minutes ago. That really does add an element of surprise. So I think most of the lessons it learns are not to be too much like those games. I think people took the sort of over-the-shoulder look and originally sort of eye-rolling, oh, look, it's just trying to be like the other games, like Resident Evil's remakes. It's like, you do realise, you know, that's been going on since Resident Evil 4. Yeah, it's not like it's a brand new thing at this point. And at that point, you know, Alone in the Dark was still alive and kicking as a franchise to a point. So I did find it odd that they did make Jeremy Hartwood was played by Paul Mercier, who is obviously the voice of Leon Kennedy. It was like, okay, that was maybe a little too on the nose. Though, in fairness, I think did a great job in terms of like differentiating voice and style. I suppose a lesson it doesn't learn very well, and the game that comes to mind here is the Callisto Protocol, is having a named actor in the main role of a horror game is a bit tough to do, I think, because unless you get things right and you have like the right level of actor where it's not important. So Alan Wake is a great example where it's like, yeah, they have people you recognize in it, but they're not always the focus and you know, like that. And they pick the right people for the right roles and often like choose a voice actor separate to the facial stuff. And
The biggest character is usually auxiliary in those. So it's like, oh, cool, there's that person that I recognize from that movie or that show, but it's never to the detriment almost of like the momentum of what's happening, because it's a chance little encounter, talk to them, get that bit of info, and then you move on.
Yeah.
And it's not this sort of like standstill, oh, hey, this completely rips me out and kills my flow of what's occurring.
Yeah, so it goes back to that old school idea of games where like the main characters look far more detailed than the rest. You know, like though I think there was some really good facial animation done on the other characters here, it's hard not to look at, you know, David Harbour and Jodie Comer and think, I'm looking at David Harbour and Jodie Comer, sort of thing like that. And it, especially with David Harbour, his voice is very distinct, and you know, it's like that, it's hard to shake the person from the role at times. I think that's maybe where I get why doing it is like, you know, it's a tentpole thing. You can bring that forward and go, hey, look, we got these people. We were only discussing this last week with Dishonored, like how that voice cast, you look at it and go, that's crazy. I mean, we have a connection here because Roger Jackson, aka Ghostface, you know, he was so cool in that game. He does radio voices in this game as well. So, yeah, and then there's a lot of cartoon voice actors where you look at them and go, oh, yeah, there's the voice of fucking Minnie Mouse and shit like that. You know, it's like being in these games, which is cool. I like it. It's just like these people are doing it because they're voice actors first, you know, like that, and they can jump between two things, and it's, you know, makes sense that they're in the game. When you have people who are primarily stage actors or, you know, cinematic actors, that has to be done right. That they have to have an understanding of it, and it's not their fault that if they don't. It's not to say they can't do it. It's just like you can tell the difference of who has honed their craft in a certain way. And so for me, that was probably the biggest mistake here. It was in terms of like learning from the past, was maybe don't front load with a celebrity unless you know how to handle it. You know, I think, you know, as a Kojima apologist, I'm going to obviously say, you know, I think he does that quite well. You know, it's like, because he doesn't just put him in one role. He just makes every fucking role like feel like it's like, you know, he can stick Jeff Keighley in the game and it doesn't feel odd,
you know, at all. Or Conan O'Brien.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, or Junji Ito. Or, yeah, and having a cast that's basically just fucking Guillermo del Toro and all that and layers to do it, being in your video game just doesn't feel odd. You know, I think you can carry that off with the right tone and style and feeling. And I go back to that and say, again, there's an example. They're all actors who come from indie spaces, kind of fits in with like the experimental nature of what Kojima does. So again, always feels in step with what's going on, whereas these roles maybe feel a little like showy, you know, and not, which is again no fault of the actors, do a fine job. I think it's just a thing that was hard to look past.
Yeah, you know, I think that this game has kind of solidified my opinion that I have no problem with, you know, cinematic actors that want to do voice acting in games and whatnot. Clearly, you know, we chatted about Dishonored, gave plenty of props for the utilization of those very seasoned cinematic actors and their voices adding more to these characters that otherwise they might just be the typical kind of like genre trope characters. But because of, you know, their very, you know, expressive talents, they're able to get a lot more out of material that otherwise might be, you know, fine, but it's just fine at the end of the day, whereas their input makes it memorable. I'm more inclined now to not want to ever see, you know, facial capturing of cinematic actors. And that's not to say, and I champion what you said, this idea that both of the actors here do a fine job, I think, with the material. I don't think either one of them give a bad performance. I think, though, that the inclusion of their faces makes it incredibly distracting to the degree that it takes me out of every interaction with them. Because, that's Hellboy.
Yeah.
Or something along those lines. So that's, Sheriff Hooper. And, you know, again, like, I think that if it had just been their voices, I think it would have been perfectly fine. I don't understand the need to have other than marketability, right? That whole thing being removed from it. I don't understand what their look adds to the experience. When I'm trying to be engrossed into this world, you're supposed to have this level of tension and whatnot. Again, every time there's a cutscene, it's just like, I'm distracted by the fact that I recognize them from the 3, 4, 6 other things that I've seen them in. Whereas, you know, you're mentioning Kojima Productions and whatnot, and how something like Death Stranding, every single person in that game basically is a memorable face. Kojima, though, like, when you go into a Kojima game such as that, you know that going in, everything is so absurd for a majority of the time, right? And that's not a slight against those experiences. It's just, it's larger than life. He's telling these crazy narratives.
Yeah. And leans into cinematic themes yes. and feelings as well, which I think obviously helps, you know, whereas video game performance generally isn't about that. You know, he's got the technology there to make the emotive performances stand out. And like I said, there's a level here with the different things where it doesn't quite work the same, because the most detailed faces are the main actors and what they look like, and everyone else is like, has, you know, if all the faces kind of look like the most of the characters, like in terms of how they moved and talked, it's like, yeah, it'd be a little janky, little off, you know, that the hair is always a problem in games like this, even for the main characters. But
even before
it, yeah. But, you know, the way the faces and the eyes move in this game in general, like, the, you know, my wife was like, just saw it in passing, was like saying, oh, wow, that facial movement looked really, like, realistic for a moment in terms of how it was. You know, without looking like, you know, an actual real face necessarily, it was just like the characteristics of the face worked, you know, like, in a way. And I think that's, again, why, you know, while this is distracting, you know, I think there are great elements of the game elsewhere which ensure that the characters are always interesting to talk to, even if they aren't like famous faces, you know, like that. And so it's not like a massive misfire. It's just like, it's one of those things that's tough to get past.
I largely agree. I think my biggest issue with the handling, I guess I should first ask, you played as Carnby?
Yeah.
Played as David Harbour's character? Yeah, as did I. The one thing that I feel is a little bit of a misfire is the handling of both of those characters in cutscenes. Mm-hmm. Because the way that essentially it works is that when you're playing as one character, their experiences, they're going into this other realm that leans into the Lovecraftian nature of the game, the supernatural stuff, but the other character is left behind in the real world, narratively speaking. So what I really actually didn't like, and, you know, I think the writing overall for this game is great, and we'll get more into it, about Mikael Hedberg's influence here, you know, him being the lead writer on The Dark Descent and Soma and whatnot, but the interactions between the two characters in cutscenes, I found to be frequently kind of annoying, to be honest. I found that a majority of their interactions, and as I played as David Harbour's character, it was him, you know, trying to explain the unexplainable, right? Which is a very common trope of Lovecraftian. The fact that I've seen the insane and me trying to describe this insane thing that I've seen to you makes me just look insane. Yeah. So why do I even bother? There are countless scenes in this game, though, where it's him trying to express what he's seen to her. She clearly does not have any idea what he's talking about or even believe him, because of the fact of, you know, he's describing this insane stuff. And it just ends up being him being very reactionary and then basically falling out of the idea of trying to even explain it halfway through. So you have these interactions where it's like, hey, I saw this. That actually doesn't make any sense. Oh, okay. Well, I'm going to go investigate this other thing. Like, I didn't feel like a lot of the interactions between the two protagonists necessarily carried a lot of weight to them or moved the narrative along in a meaningful way or established any sort of relationship between them in a meaningful way, to the degree that, while again, like I thought their performances were good, I didn't necessarily like get a sense of these characters past sort of just their basic relationship, which, you know, not to say that I was expecting something to be like, oh, Leon and Claire, like all of a sudden their relationship like flourishes based on their experiences. But I wish that the two protagonists had had actually some semblance of common ground to build a bond. So I would think about the other person while I was exploring the Dracetto Mansion, whereas I could care less about that other character for majority of the game because, oh, well, they can't relate to anything that I can relate to other than, hey, Jeremy's still missing. I'm curious, how did you kind of find their relationship throughout the course of the game?
I suppose this goes back to what we're saying about the difference between actors who used to voice work often working without hearing the other person, in fact, like that, and having to sort of gauge what they think the reaction should be and like that. And it feels at times like there is that clash where they are two people who are used to acting across from each other, acting separately. Yeah, you know, maybe they did work together at the same time, I don't know, but it doesn't feel like it in certain things. I think the very nature of the game and its pacing as well, that everything feels weirdly relaxed in the way stuff is talked about, that there's never, you know, histrionics aren't this game's strong point. It tries to play everything fairly normal, which is, I think, a very good thing to do for what the story is telling and how things are going on in the background. It's like, if you get hysterics involved and get overly emotional like that, it becomes, you know, it's the difference between, you know, like a really brooding sort of atmospheric dread feel and something more like, and again, not a knock on this, but, you know, John Carpenter's Mouth of Madness, you know, it's, you know, it gets really chaotic and in your face about what it's doing. And it's like, that works, that's fine. But, you know, given the story and the atmosphere and the place, you know, it feels right that it has to be quite, you know, sanguine in how everything is. And maybe that's a problem in trying to sort of get those scenes where you are trying to sort of connect the characters and the story. I mean, in fairness, I go back to the Leon Claire thing and I think, well, to be fair, it's not too dissimilar. I think, you know, their reaction together is like, sure, their bond is over survival, but their stories are very separate most of the time, apart from like a couple of fleeting scenes together. And it kind of makes you think, well, apart from survival, you'd not really spent most of the night together sort of thing. It's like you just happened to get here at the same time like that. And always been one of the most frustrating things for me that was never explored further really properly in subsequent games, where that their relationship. And so for me, it's never felt like a big deal like it should have done.
I suppose, though, that's one thing that I wish that they had learned from.
Yeah. Right?
The idea, if you're going to have these two characters, you know, they're not going to spend a great deal of time together, but if you're going to have them interact or even have separate characters.
Yes.
Have the few scenes where they are sharing the space and communicating with one another, make it more meaningful or make it have more of an impact. Because otherwise, if you're rebooting this game, and to the best of my knowledge, there's never been more than one playable character in an Alone in the Dark game. Just give us one character then. If one is going to be, I don't even want to get into stronger or not, but it's just, it was just one of those things where I was like, I see a lot of potential here. This is a lesson that could be learned.
Mm.
It just simply wasn't, I suppose.
And I think it is also just how they're trying to balance it out so that whichever side of it you play is to make the character you're playing as feel like the important one, like the protagonist of the story. Which, as I said, doesn't meld as well if you don't have those scenes where you really feel they have a connection and dovetail together. In a way, it's almost like not so much like different perspectives as like retellings of the story again, much like Resident Evil 2 does. But yeah, it's debatable whether we needed to go full on. I think maybe here's a lesson that could have been learned, is that you look at, say, Resident Evil 4, where you have your Ashley bits and they are separate, and you sort of dovetail them in between the bits where you are. Yeah, can be. But people don't always like that. You know, I mean, to this day, people piss on the Spider-Man games for that anytime you're Mary Jane. So, you know, it's like, even when they made it better in the sequel, it's like, no, no, it's still not the same sort of thing. And now you've made it too OP and all this shit. And it's like, okay, but you know, if you want both perspectives and you want, you need to find the right balance. And maybe that's the problem here, is that in trying to find a balance between the two and giving them both an importance, it doesn't really give either a connection, you know, when it matters.
I guess for me, yeah, it's one of those things where it's like, I saw a lot of potential of including these two characters, having two distinctly different characters that, as you learn throughout playing the game, have their own backgrounds in grief. I suppose, though, when I look at the handling of those characters, the star power behind them, it feels like a little bit of a missed opportunity to really, you know, kind of dive into those roles in a more meaningful way, I think. We're going to talk more about the narrative of this game and, you know, overall Alone in the Dark's approach to world building once we come back from our very brief break. And we are back from our break, and we're going to chat a little bit more about the lore of the world of Alone in the Dark and whatnot. And, you know, for me, what I was actually pretty taken aback by was the amount of world building that goes into this game through those collectible notes and whatnot. And while there are going to be notes that are essentially unmissable to the degree that, like, to get clues and hints and things like that for puzzles, you have to scour environments. But there's a lot of flavor text to this world. And, you know, that you're going to find some tomes of whatnot and scrolls and these things that flesh out Dorsetto Mansion's history, you know, 100, 200 years before the game actually takes place in the present day. And, you know, some things that allude to, like, events that maybe happened just before you arrived there. And, you know, that's all pretty commonplace for, you know, games or survival horror games in general. But there is a depth and a craft and a amount of voice acting that goes into each of those that I was really impressed with every step of the way, to the degree that it felt like not a single document was wasted.
No.
Everything felt meaningful. And, you know, a good portion of it might be missable for people that, you know, are not as meticulous in scouring environments, or, you know, they're just trying to get from A to B and find the most important documents. But that ended up being probably my favorite aspect of the narrative, was just learning about the Dorsetto Mansion, understanding, you know, or trying to understand some of the oddities that are occurring around there and the supernatural forces that are at work. That ended up being something that, from a production value standpoint, and it's credit to Mikhail Hedberg, you know, being the chief writer on this, like, there is such a depth to the flavor text in this game that was really took me aback. And it made me not want to scour, not want to miss any single document that I came across, because of the fact everything is fully voiced.
Yeah.
There's a variety of voice actors. They have, you know, incredible inflection in terms of when they need to enunciate certain points that, you know, have the most amount of emphasis on the supernatural or just importance to them. And those performances, I think, ended up being more standout for me than, you know, the two Hollywood stars at the helm of this.
Yeah. I mean, the whole being voiced thing is a great addition, because instantly it makes you take notice more than just skimming over stuff. And again, I go back to the pace of the game really suits just drinking everything in. But what really impressed me with that was that, you know, they don't just, like, read what's on the note all the time. They sometimes give you, like, a wider fleshing out of what goes on beyond that note. Like, if it's a conversation, there'll be two voices and, you know, like, a back and forth, and, you know, it goes beyond the note. And so, you know, reading it's one thing, but you can learn a bit more by hearing it as well, which is, like, really cool. As, you know, it's the combination of the audio log and the, you know, the notes being strewn around sort of thing. But it works so well, you know, and it, you can see where the heritage is there and how that's been evolved upon. And I mean, maybe that's the thing we should have brought up earlier, but obviously I think it's the time to bring it up. In terms of, like, learning from previous mistakes and evolutions in this genre, is to make those things interesting and make you care about them beyond just, like, oh, there's a code in here or something like that. It's like, I mean, they require you to really look into it at times and really just read between the lines as well, which I really like, you know, in terms of the puzzles and how they integrate those. It's such a great variety of note writing. And it, as you say, it really does just make this feel like this bigger thing, this bigger world. And, you know, it legitimizes everything that the game throws at you as well, I think, when you get into it. So, yeah, it is, again, it does show the disparity between, you know, what works in the world of games and what works in the world of Hollywood sort of thing. It doesn't always gel, you know, it's a bit oil and water, but still, I think this is, yeah, definitely a highlight among the things this game does well.
Ultimately, that makes Dersetto in reality much more interesting, given that, you know, I found that the more straightforward sort of just mansion itself in the reality world is kind of unremarkable. Didn't find it to be as engaging as I thought until you add in all the supernatural aspects and whatnot. The fact that, and it's not just that, you know, when you explore parts of the mansion, like it changes suddenly or something like that, or it brings in a new environment to an area that wasn't there previously. But everything is tied to the history of Dersetto Mansion and, more importantly, the residents, right? That ends up becoming a huge component of it, is that a lot of what you're experiencing in this supernatural realm is Jeremy's memories, which, when you talk about Lovecraftian, when you talk about horror, it's this thing where it's like, it's not just about, and we've talked about this multiple times over the last few months, it's not just tentacle monsters, which, to be fair, this game has its share of. But more importantly, it is based in grief. And those are the best aspects of this game, I think, is that when it draws, it leans into that, right? You have that with both of your protagonists, which is probably my favorite chapter in the game, which I think is in chapter 4. Depending on who you're playing, there's a whole chapter in a unique environment that's based around those characters and dealing with their grief. I played as Carnby, as you did, and that was about the fact that there's a character that you see in Dersetto who is, you know, tied to Carnby's past, the fact that, you know, her father was killed, and he basically thought like, oh, I'm going to rescue this girl from this husband that has stolen the daughter from the wife. And then you find out there's a lot more to that narrative, but it's all about Carnby's history, which then also ties into the environment of the bayou and all of these things. Likewise with, you know, Emily having to deal with abandoning her husband in Dersetto when he was injured during the war and whatnot. And, you know, those are the aspects that I think of the narrative work the best because of all of the sort of scaffolding and foundation that's gone around of creating this environment of ever changing, but it's ever related to the people that are occupying this space, or, you know, sometimes people that may be passed away in that space. But more importantly, you know, it's drawing from this rich history that is felt within the opening hour of reading, you know, three or four documents. And I think that this game stands as a testament to just how important world building is on top of your narrative, right? I think if anything, the world building bolsters the narrative of this game a lot more than maybe in some other games, just because of, again, how strong of a sense of place it is.
Yeah.
And giving more credence, I think, to when, you know, you go through this door, all of a sudden you're walking down Bourbon Street in New Orleans or something along those lines. Like, I think that it does a lot more to justify the inclusion of that. Oh, opening a door to a new place when you have some of the history, you have some of the background or the significance of it.
Yeah. I think when you talk about layers of fear and like the transition between, you know, manifestations, you know, it's very much more psychological in that sense of like being very singular of a person, whereas this is, you know, quite easy, you know, it's explained away as being, you know, like just what happens with this, you know, other people's memories being part of this whole haunting of this place and it being beyond our comprehension. It's not a madness in the traditional sense. It's more like an invoked madness. And so, yeah, it does start to become strangely comfortable to sort of be moving to these different areas and giving you not just, you know, more flavor in the story, but more flavor of the place, you know, in terms of like being in Louisiana and like beyond the house, which, you know, I think, yeah, it has that feel, you know, Alone in the Dark and the Dersetto Manor always reminds me of, you know, the big old manor in Fulci's The Beyond. You know, it's like got that sort of yeah, the gateway to hell thing going on, and you know, it's a really good sort of touchstone. And there's elements of that here as well, where by going wider than the house itself, you kind of get a better sense of the house being there in that place. And while the house is unremarkable, I think that is like part of the appeal, is, you know, the house is the house. It's not the house that's a problem. It's what the house has you know, got in it, and all it, what its history in where it was built. You know, the house is just there. You know, it's
just the house.
Yeah, hence why, you know, it can take you to all these different places. And it's got some unnerving qualities. You know, a lot is made of like the use of space, and especially these days, liminal space and things, in terms of like being unsettling. I know I was only talking about this earlier about how that's not always very well applied in what people now think that has to be. When you think that that's been used brilliantly in unsettling people, when you think back to what Kubrick did with The Shining, you know, in terms of like making a place feel normal, but also far beyond what it is and feel unnatural, you know, famously in that film, you know, it's the hotel structure just doesn't make sense in terms of where they go and what they do like that. And this sort of plays with that by having a place that makes sense, you know, in that you can go from point A to point B, you know, where to go once you get used to the layout. But because it throws these weird curveballs at you in terms of like places you go at any given point, you never get to feel comfortable in the environment. And because you never know what's next. Like, sure, I know what's in this room and what's in that place, but it's like the house isn't really the threat. It's what can manifest in this house and where it can take you. And, you know, you were sort of saying about the Lovecraftian nature of the monsters, you know, and tentacle monsters. I mean, Guy Davis is responsible for the monster. You know, he's worked with Guillermo del Toro, you know, and done lots of good stuff with him. And it shows, I think, in some of the monster design especially. It feels very much like what you would expect in a del Toro cosmic horror-style film, you know, in so many ways. So I was generally impressed with that. And having those turn up, in not only in like environments that are familiar, but in almost their natural habitat, if you will, is probably the most connective tissue we have to like what stuff that Hedberg had done with stuff like Amnesia, where it is like, and you think to lay again, like Rebirth, especially where you go to the more cosmic realm and really take, you know, in that side of the equation, you do start to get that feeling of like something of beyond what you are in properly. Like that, and I go back to the beyond, you know, where you get to the end of that and you know, that's a stinger of an ending where they are just like this cosmic plane elsewhere. And it just feels so like, what the fuck sort of thing like that. I love that. And so it did endear me to this game a lot that, you know, it had things like that going on.
You know, you mentioned Guy Davis's monster design in this game. And I think that ultimately is where, you know, we're going to get to combat. But the monster designs and the creatures, like, that is handled so much better than I was expecting, right? I went into this expecting it to be more in line with the original game, where it's more of a haunted house of horrors, right? Whereas this game is more about, you know, it being a house that is filled with portals to grief and core memories of past regrets and whatnot. And so to have the monsters primarily occupy those spaces was such a smart design decision, because of the fact that, you know, you are essentially making sure that the player realizes that Dorsetto and the horrors are separate, but at the same time, they both have their own brand of horrors. And I found that to be really integral to the idea of separating the two, but at the same time, allowing them to come together in a way thematically, but in two very different ways. And, you know, in terms of the monster design, there's not a great deal of them in this game, but I found that, much like with the original game, there was a good variety of monsters that, you know, are both grotesque in their construction, but at the same time, there is this unknowing quality almost to a certain degree that the original had, where the original, it was room by room. You had no idea what was going to be there next, right? It was either going to be a zombie or a tentacle monster or a hopping rabid dog looking creature. And in this, it's similar in that, you know, you can't really predict what is going to come at you in the next zone or the next area. Granted, not all designs and their sort of combat patterns are created equally, but at the same time, I thought there was a nice scale, at least, to the monsters mm-hmm. that you're fighting, to the degree that later on, when you get to like the two boss fights at the end of the game, those both in their designs, both aesthetically, but also in their combat patterns, are very distinctly different from what you faced up until that point, which again has this kind of like nice scale that you can almost feel the game beginning to get to its conclusion without, you know, explicitly being told that. But, you know, I think that's going to lead us into what is maybe the most frightening aspect of this game, which is its combat. I'm curious, you know, the Alone in the Dark's combat at this point, I think, has been more or less been a sticking point for a lot of, I think, you know, reviews that I had read and sort of, I suppose, scuttlebutt and whatnot online. How did you find the combat in the Alone in the Dark reboot? Because I have many, many thoughts of this on this.
Oh, well, we may disagree. I don't know. well, yeah, I don't think this is a game where combat was really at the forefront of what it was supposed to be. And that's understandable. It's very much at its best when it's being investigative and, you know, when you are really delving into what is going on. You know, that's quite apparent. You know, the strengths of this game lie in, you know, the people making it have had that experience with games that are very narrative focused, very much in about that. And, you know, I love the Amnesia series, but, you know, the Dark Descent now for me is slightly irritating in what it comes to actual confrontational stuff, because I feel like the later games have dealt with it in a better way, you know, and made it so that, you know, you could evolve on that. Here, it feels like they didn't really answer the question in terms of, like, a lot of the combat. There is the option for avoidance, of course, you know, to a degree, but it's not always there. And, you know, you can pick up, like, debris, rocks, whatever like that to distract, but that system doesn't feel particularly consistent either. And then when you get into the combat itself, it's like, you know, ammo is limited. You know, you are very much like, it's fight or flight sort of thing in any given situation. So the structure, the underlying structure of it should work. You should have something that means that you can make a choice in a fight, and then occasionally you will have no choice like that. And that, to a fair extent, I think it does that. It's just, it's not always easy to make that choice, I think, is the biggest problem. Is like, you don't always have the out you wish you had, because not because the game doesn't give it to you, it's just like the timing of the situation means you just can't, and you'll take a few licks or you get stranded or lost in a situation, and yeah, it can be frustrating. And hit detection, well, you know, not always there, I think, to be fair. Given how few enemies there are, I think it shouldn't be the issue it is, in terms of like making sure that corresponds with what you are fighting and where and the weapons. I mean, I almost found that the combat was at its best and at the right, the best balance before you get a shotgun like that. And after that point, that's kind of where it starts going beyond its means. And I get why you want to vary things up, but I think it's already got that by going to different environments and going to different places. And it feels like a response to the sort of people that looked at like Amnesia Rebirth and go, same stuff, no combat horror, like that. And like, it's, which is ridiculous. You know, you can't exist. And I get wanting to explore that and try to marry that sort of early frictional stuff with like more modern sensibility in terms of combat. But there's a reason why, you know, it's not a celebrated aspect of Alone in the Dark, in the same way that we will probably get the same debate when we come to Silent Hill 2 and its remake. People have already blown off about the idea of combat in the game. Play the fucking game. It had it. It was just not very good. But and yeah, so you know, in a sense of modernizing it, in a way it makes it better. In another way, no, it doesn't. But I don't think it's the disaster it could have been. I just think it's not the most refined part of the game.
Oh man, a rarity on Safe Room where we're completely opposite end. For me, I totally agree in terms of like that was the one aspect of the original Alone in the Dark when we covered it that didn't click with me. And 30 plus years later, it still does not. Unfortunately, it seems like they did not learn some of the missteps from combat in the original game. And even in modernizing it for a new reboot, it seems like some of those lessons were still not learned. So I guess one of my biggest problems is that the combat ultimately for me is way too unwieldy, which is made even worse by the fact that in certain portions of the game, primarily around, you know, that mark that you mentioned after you get the shotgun and whatnot, you get attacked by mobs, essentially. If it's like two enemies or something along those lines, which I can't even remember, the original Alone in the Dark, I don't think I ever had to deal with more than two or three enemies at a time. But there are some instances in the reboot where you get chased by five or six or seven enemies at a time, which does not lend itself to weapons that are, I found to be very inaccurate. They lack any semblance of stopping power. It didn't seem like, you know, typically when you're playing a game, you get the sense of like, okay, if I hit this guy with the shotgun, he's a bigger enemy. One shotgun, one or two pistol rounds or a melee round will finish him off. I didn't feel like there was any sort of, I suppose, like, trends in how much weapons deal damage to certain enemy types or how effective they can be, to the degree that I kind of just was going with whatever I had, and I had to end up basically emptying most of my barrels in dealing with one enemy before going on to the next. Weapons, as I mentioned, don't have much of a punch to them to the degree that they should. Like we've always talked about in a survival horror game, if you have combat, you live and die by how effective and how satisfying that shotgun is to use. Didn't find it to be at all satisfying in this, which is a mortal sin in my opinion. But what I completely don't understand is the utilization of throwables that you find in environments. When you come across them, it's either a bottle to distract enemies, or later in the game, it's a Molotov cocktail, right? And so when you go up to them on Xbox, you have to hold, I think it's like right trigger, but you can't release that and you can't add the item to your inventory unless you want to use it. So basically you go up to it, you hold right trigger, and then you either have to throw it or throw it at your feet if you don't want to use it, kind of thing, which was some of the most baffling design that I'd seen in a game, in a modern game in that way. Because, you know, the obvious go-to would be, oh, I found a bottle, I'm going to put that in my pocket. And then when I creep around and maneuver myself, so that way when I'm ready, I can use it as a lure or bait or something like that. That's not the case. To the degree that I didn't realize you could move with those items for like the first hour or two of the game, because of the fact it gives you that prompt that's like, hey, grab that, because as soon as you let go of this trigger, you have to release it. But at the same time, like that just felt like such an antiquated piece of design, because there are so many utilizations for those features, but you really feel kind of pigeonholed to the fact that it's like, okay, you pick it up, you better use it, because otherwise you're going to waste it, type of thing. Then that stems into my disdain for melee combat in this, where I felt like I was kind of just flailing rather than getting a semblance of like, if I basically orient my body in this direction, even if there isn't a reticle for melee, I'll still at least hit in the zone. And melee just felt too unwieldy. Weapons also have a durability, which is fine, but I felt like the durability for weapons was only good for one monster. So all of a sudden it's kind of just like, okay, so this is good for like three swings and then it's basically broken. And the instances where you need to use a weapon, a melee weapon, to like get through an environmental barrier, there's unlimited melee weapons lying around. So it's kind of just like, okay, I guess like, sure, this can have a puzzle utilization for it, but all of a sudden I have unlimited melee weapons that I can just go back to. And I think, I suppose my last sort of critique on that is, well, actually I have a few more, but I guess the last major one is the fact that later on in the game, you're faced with, you know, basically like giant stink bugs, right? That, you know, fine, you've got smaller enemies and whatnot you have to contend with, but even on normal difficulty, and I'm thinking primarily about the section on Carnby's grief chapter when you go on the steamboat, those little sons of bitches hit incredibly hard, to the degree that they hit harder than some of the bigger enemies that you fight. But what is a bigger issue is the fact that the aiming is so unwieldy that it's almost impossible, I found, to hit them. But also, like, you have this melee weapon, and it's incredibly difficult to hit them with that because of the fact there's no lock on. And even if there wasn't a lock on, that's fine. And there isn't a lock on. But it's that even if I was orienting my body in the direction of them and, like, looking down at my feet to, like, swing at them, I was still missing 75% of the time because, again, if you're not perfectly in that swing pattern, you're going to miss them. Likewise, you're going to fight flying enemies, which is the same issue, is that if you try to swing at them, you miss most of the time. And then, you know, unless you're using the shotgun, they're so agile that it can be incredibly difficult to hit them. And that just made that whole section way more frustrating than I thought it needed to be.
Yeah, I mean, little fuckers are always the worst thing in any horror game. It's like every time. It's like, yeah, if you haven't got the right skills and mechanics for it, it is just... Yeah, I mean, that is probably one of the most glaring things, I think, in what you're bringing up there, is that if you are going to have small fuckers to fight, then you need to have something that is a good small fucker smacker, you know, and
yeah.
You don't have it like that.
We need to trademark that.
Yeah, that's it. You know, actually correlating it to playing Half-Life 2 again this week and get the head crabs and stuff like that, where...
Mm.
Going back to it, it's hard to train your brain that, you know, it's fine to use the crowbar in those situations like that. It's meant for them, you know, because trying to shoot them with a pistol in it, when it's all going crazy that first time you were like in the sewage, you know, sewer tunnels and stuff like that, and you get all the head crab zombies and things. You know, it goes chaotic all of a sudden, and you start relying too much on the gun. You don't really get anything done because they're just flicking around the place, and then there's fire and zombies and whatever, and it's like, yeah, you've got a weapon there. It's just remembering you've got the weapon there and remembering your set. Whereas this is very much a case of, like, nothing really works and you kind of have to evade until you can figure out the right spot, which I think is something the game doesn't communicate very well, is that, you know, combat is very much about, like, where you are when you're doing anything and making sure you're in the right place at the right time to make your attacks effective. Not just because of, like, you know, tactically that's where it makes sense, but also because of the shortcomings of the combat in terms of, like, hit detection and things like that. You kind of have to fight against it and make that part of what you're doing, unfortunately. I mean, so there's a way around it, so to speak, but it does require patience and frustration, you know, to get to that point, which obviously is not what you want to be your selling point as a combat mechanic.
Well, you just reminded me, I have not done with my issues with the combat in mentioning the dodge. The dodge in this, which, you know, is a more than standard convention of not only horror games, but games in general at this point that feature combat. So the main issue that we had with the original Alone in the Dark with combat is the fact that you can get caught in the enemy's fight animation loop, basically. Where they would hit you, your guy would react, but by the time your character returns to their resting state from reacting to getting hit, the enemy has already hit you or is already wound up with another hit, which just ends up being this infinite loop. Now, you would assume that a dodge button would get you out of that to avoid. I still found that frequently, and, you know, again, coming back to this idea of why am I having to fight an entire mob of enemies at certain points in this game, I would dodge my way from one enemy, but there'd be two or three other enemies sometimes surrounding me that then would be doing their attack animations that then I would get caught in. So I would dodge from one enemy to another enemy that I was getting hit by, dodging to another enemy. And it just ended up being the snowball effect of frustration, basically, at certain junctions in the combat that I would just get stuck in those and then, you know, die and then have to reboot and whatnot. And there is not a great cost to death, especially when if you die, your gun, I think, reloads automatically. Mm. So like if you're playing on harder difficulties, you don't have to worry about running out of ammo if you die, but it just made for a mechanic such as dodge that should have been rectifying an issue, whereas it just ended up compounding an issue in a way for me when I played. And then on top of that, I still, to this, you know, 2 or 3 weeks after release, still was encountering this issue of, like, clipping into environments and getting stuck in them. You know, sometimes it would be, I would dodge out of the way of an enemy's attack, but if there was, like, some other miniature little part of the environment, like some vases or some crates, I could basically dodge and then clip into that and be stuck there and then spend, you know, the next 10 seconds trying to dodge my way out of the environment while getting attacked by other enemies. So that was one of those little things where I was just like, that happened. You know, I wouldn't say it happened to every combat encounter, but it was frequent enough that I'm bringing it up. And, you know, I tend to not try to nitpick like little glitches or little bugs like that if they occur, you know, once in a while. But like, it happened frequently enough with combat that it ended up being kind of a pain in the ass, if I'm being honest.
That seems to be like one of those things that with this game, which is like either happens to you a lot or it doesn't. I think the Bethesda effect, if you will. You know, like someone will play a Fallout game and it'll be the buggiest thing they've ever played. The next person will be like, didn't really see much wrong with that sort of thing. It's just circumstantial. So yeah, while I did get that occasionally happen, it never seemed to happen in any bad, you know, combat heavy situation, thankfully. But I think I've seen enough people say each version of it to suggest that yeah, it's very much a luck of the draw in terms of what you get with that one.
I played on a Series X. What did you play on?
PS5.
Yeah. Okay. Did you encounter any audio issues? Because I had frequent audio issues for probably the first half of I spent 9 hours on my playthrough. And for the first half of the game, I had audio issues that I assume they got patched out. But I had this issue where sometimes voices weren't coming in properly. And then, you know, more annoyingly with combat, the first shot out of a gun would not sync up with the audio. And then it would be almost delayed. And then it would snap back into like...
Yeah, I mean, again, minimal things. I had some issues here and there, but most of the problems were front loaded, you know, in this. You know, it's like you do get that with some games where you have the first hour or so it's going for its teething problems. You know, I was saying earlier, it's like I had that with that first hour where you can see where they're trying to paper over the cracks a bit here and there, and with the technical problems and the audio issues occasionally do come through. But I don't know, compared to some games I've played recently, you know, good and bad, I think it's actually fairly decent in terms of what I got. So yeah, I mean, this is clearly informing a lot of our experiences as being quite different in this case. But no more than I would have seen out of any other game of this size, I would say.
My frustrations with combat stem from, I suppose, some of the brief instances of like ingenuity or creativity in sections where combat is a factor. Like primarily there's, I keep coming back to it because it's my favorite chapter, I think, and that's chapter 4 when you're dealing with Carnby's grief. You know, he is delving into his own past with the case that he was working and basically blundered his way through. And that's when he's like piecing together bits of evidence with an old case. And there's this stylistic feature where he's basically following, you know, anytime you've seen sort of like 40s detectives that have been queuing or connecting rather different clues together, they have that red string, right? And so there's that whole chapter where he's following red string in the environment to lead him to the next area that then, you know, divulges more information about the case and whatnot, which was such a cool little feature where it's like you see this red string in the air, but then it also interacts with parts of the environment. So it wraps around either staircase banisters or it'll wrap around telephone poles and like just little stylistic things like that. I was like, oh, I could have used more things like that throughout, maybe even Dorsetto Mansion, right? Kind of bridging the gap between sanity and reality or insanity and reality. But at the same time, like there's a whole Arctic section towards the end of the game and they introduce like a flare gun. And you use that to traverse this massive environment that for the most part is dark because it's at night in the Arctic. And, you know, that's just used to illuminate sections of the map. But like little instances like that, I thought were like, A, gives you a new weapon, but it's more about the fact that it helps you traverse the environment.
Yeah.
And I almost wish that like there was a little bit more complexity to how you explore environments. Even if, you know, they don't all have to just be like illuminating or being a source of light. I guess I just wanted to see a little bit more in terms of like how you can actually affect the environment around you. Other than just kind of anticipating when one of those like gator creatures will jump out of the ground or when you'll get attacked by like a creature that's covered in vines and whatnot. But I guess that also brings up like the two boss battles in the game. And one of them I love in that Arctic section because of the fact the character model, basically it reminded me of like Bennings from The Thing, that character that, you know, the rest of the group discovers is halfway through a transformation. So you just see like that elongated limb, but then that in this game continues. So it's this massive kind of sprawling humanoid creature. But at the same time, like, I love the monster design. In functionality, though, it kind of plays like a PS2 era boss fight almost, yeah, where it's like you deal enough damage, he falls down, you stab him with something, and that takes out a bigger chunk of his health, and then you got to do that 3 or 4 times. But then that leads you into like the final boss monster, which is this kind of tentacle tree creature, basically, which I like the design of it. But then when it comes time to actually like fighting the creature, it's like you just shoot these sacks that appear on it while dealing with mini waves of enemies that are basically a pain in the ass to fight because of how chaotic that environment is and how constricted it is. That like arena that you're fighting in is like very constricted. And then you've got a monster that takes up 3/4 of the environment. So it was that thing where it's like, I saw brief glimpses of a lot of creativity. It was just, I wanted to see more of it, I think, because there's always, each environment has one little thing about it that's unique. It's just like, they almost didn't lean into it enough for me, I think.
There's a lot of this game where I feel like they needed a game before it to sort of hone some stuff, you know, something smaller to, you know, with less ambition in terms of like technical and you know, in terms of piecing all this together. I think many of the game's problems do stem from being overly ambitious in terms of trying to make it fit, you know, reaching for the stars of what Capcom can do, which, you know, Capcom can put more money into a game than pieces can, you know, and still it can be for them a budget game, you know, because they can now extend that engine, you know, into many, many games, you know, and it can evolve and shape and change to the fact that, you know, you've gone from, wow, look, they made Resident Evil 2 remake look like this with this engine to, there's a whole fucking open world RPG now out there now where you can fucking jump on monsters and stab them and stuff. And it's like, you know, Elden Ring-esque in terms of like its scope and scale. It's like that engine has become like massively adaptable and lucrative because now they don't have to rely on a third party. They don't have to worry about any of that. You're not going to get that here. And you're going to have to rely on like third party stuff to get to what you're doing. So you need maybe to have that mid-step where you are just doing something a bit smaller. But I get, given the team and where they've come from, they've had that step in some ways, but they've been very much more narrative focused. They needed to really tackle combat in a way that I know pieces have mostly done like Magicka games. I think they did Magicka 2, what was that?
Yeah.
And that's a very different kind of combat experience, you know, to survival horror.
Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I think that's, if you're going to learn anything from this one, it would be that. The combat, no matter, you know, while our takes on them are different, I think we can agree that, you know, that is where it needs shaping up the most, you know, more than anything else. I'd imagine that if it hasn't done well enough financially, then they might have the blessing of like not worrying about name actors in the lead role sort of thing. You know, and critically, I think it's done well enough for that to probably happen anyway. Even, you know, even like in stuff that we've seen with that game in terms of like them talking about their experience making the game, it feels like that disconnected sort of, I made this animated movie, blah, blah, blah sort of thing like that, where from right. people who don't really do that, you know. And so, yeah, maybe it'll be a blessing in that they'll get, you know, to use a more consistent cast. And so that won't, because I think that does feed into a lot of it, you know, in terms of like the disconnect between what does and doesn't work. And when you talk about why don't the interactions between them feel right, it's like because they're two famous people, you expect them to have equal footing and like to them to mean something. You know, it's like you've got Jodie Comer, if you only ever play one side of the story, you're not getting your money's worth out of it, you know, in terms of that. I mean, that's then on you, of course, if you don't, but it's still like, you know, if you are playing it for one time and experiencing the story one time, you are not making the most of having two name actors at that point. This is a very interesting sort of, it's a swing, you know, they've really gone for it in so many ways. And I mean, it does worry you slightly of what it would have been like had it come out back when it did. I think it still ended up getting gypped by coming out when it did this time, much like it would have then with Alan Wake 2. Now it came out, you know, when you had all these other big games coming out at the same time and stealing the spotlight and making people, I mean, Dragon's Dogma 2, funnily enough, that I was just talking about before, by Capcom using that RE engine. There it is, a game that's come out of nowhere that's basically just given people a very different idea of how these things can work. And then for reviewers playing that and that close proximity, not good. No, you know, in terms of like, you know, it just accentuates the flaws more. You know, not that game doesn't have flaws. So I think really there was no great time to put it out if this was always going to be the problem. But hopefully it's done well enough, and it's done all right by the seams of it, from a commercial standpoint, which means it gives them scope to make another one. Hopefully the next one where they're making more of their own story, hopefully, and they can really sort of jump on from this, and we get something that has all the flavour, but maybe has a bit more meat to the things that matter.
Final question. How did we feel about the puzzles that were within the Dracetto Mansion? Because that was an aspect we haven't touched upon really, but I'm curious for you. Like, what did you think about those?
Yeah, I liked them. I mean, I don't know what more to say other than that they aren't always consistent in terms of like how tough or easy they are, but I don't think that's a problem. I think you can have that full range and width, and it's like some puzzles can just be like, pick this thing up, take it to that place. I don't care. That's great. It's, if all your puzzles are like that, then that's a problem. But it isn't. And some of them, like I said, really require thought and care and like to listen and read and really embrace the world itself to actually get into it. And I like that in a horror game. I like to have puzzles that, you know, unlike, you know, again, when I go back to Resident Evil, you know, a lot of those puzzles are absurd because of the way they're put together in terms of like, why do I need this and this in a police station to make this happen? Like that sort of thing. Here, right. Yeah, even with the backstory that's there, it's not strong enough to make you go, well, that's a bit stupid. Like, I mean, Resident Evil's whole thing is like Umbrella are fucking rich, stupid people, and they've made all this stuff happen. So, of course, they've done really extravagant and indulgent things. But here it's like, you know, there's meaning and connection to pretty much most of the things you do, like that. And you know, early on with the disc puzzles and things like that, I found that really interesting in terms of how it sort of played into other puzzles and like finding stuff in the environment. And like, yeah, it's, yeah, I think there's a good variety of puzzles in it, and nothing ever really left me stumped either. I think it was the portal sweet spot of like being challenging but accessible.
Yeah, no, that's a great way to put it, in that it's something that gives you maybe slight pause, but then, you know, you spend more than 2 minutes looking at any puzzle. It's like, oh, okay, I see what I have to do here. But I think that it wasn't so much for me like any one puzzle was remarkable, but rather the fact that each puzzle leans into the aspect of this game that I like the most, which is, again, the fact that it's tying into these memories and these other worlds, and that every time you solve a puzzle, you get that reward of, I'm going to go into this other reality or this other sort of supernatural aspect of the story, which I ultimately found to be incredibly rewarding, even if maybe, you know, somebody that's a diehard puzzle fan or even just people that like a good puzzle challenge, they might not get that satisfaction just from the puzzles that are presented here. At the end of the day, though, like narratively, there is a reward there, which for somebody like myself, that, you know, Portal is that sweet spot where it's just like, you might fuss about with something for 5 minutes, 10 minutes, but then at the end of the day, it's not going to like leave you stumped in the way that maybe some more hardcore puzzle games are. But yeah, you know, I think that it's the type of thing where this game, you know, I had probably more negative things to say about it, but at the same time, for a reboot of Alone in the Dark, and you know, you can look at the track record of that series. I think that it is an incredibly promising reboot that shows that this is a studio that is able to take the aspects from the original game that were there, make them their own, and flesh them out in a way that is probably the best example of modernizing a old school franchise from a narrative standpoint or a world building standpoint. Yeah. But at the same time, perhaps moving away from the inclination of like, well, we can bolster this game with having big name stars attached to it and whatnot. Moving away from that, I think will allow them, hopefully in the future, if they get that follow-up attempt at continuing the series, to really hone in on the aspects in the reboot that maybe didn't quite hit the mark, were not nearly as polished as they should have been. Because I think the foundation of what was here from, again, this narrative standpoint and just a world-building standpoint and the lore of this place, of this world, is so incredibly strong. And I think head and shoulders above some games that, you know, while they might nail the combat, sometimes it's the case where I could give fuck all about the world. And so to have a game where from day one, I'm really invested in that world and that environment and just seeing the sort of the Lovecraftian potential of it was sublime, I think, in a way. It's just kind of allowing the other aspects of the game itself to maybe be kind of bolstered in a way that makes it, I don't know, I hesitate to say more fun, but I suppose having more of a unique personality to it, right? I think refining combat first and foremost, at the same time, maybe moving away from the allure of having, you know, Hollywood stars at the helm of it.
Yeah. And I suppose when at the end of the day, you look at this and you really have to think about how you're looking at it. And if it's you're looking at it in comparison to reboots similar in the same genre, it's got less money than the others. There's no doubt about that. You know, it's less financing behind it. It's double A by compared to triple, if you're going that sort of terminology. So it's kind of unfair to judge it directly on that, like that. And then if you're comparing it to, you know, the body of work that's come before from the people involved, then it's like, well, you know, it's doing those things right. So that's good. So then you look at the real sort of comparative games and points, like I said, the Frogwares stuff, which I think, you know, it does a lot of stuff on par with. I think, you know, Frogwares is, you know, very much more intricate in terms of like puzzles and things because it's really central to the Sherlock Holmes game, for instance. But this is a better sort of cosmic horror game than like The Sinking City, which is a good one. You know, I really enjoy The Sinking City. But I, you know, that wasn't without its technical problems and, you know, combat issues. I think it really captured the Lovecraft idea of cosmic horror quite well. But this captures the more general sort of idea of cosmic horror, you know, and which is what always what I prefer, if you can. So in that space, I think it's, you know, a fair success in what it does. I think you can compare it to the big hitters if you want, and I get that. But it's not really that kind of game, even in tone, even in style. It's just unfortunately because it's chosen, you know, the camera angle it has and it's chosen the combat system it has, that is what it would be compared to. You know, it's going to be compared to your Dead Spaces, your Resis and things like that because of that. But, you know, this franchise has been dead for a long time. You know, serial burners of everything, Atari, touched this and killed it like they did. You know, the film adaptation did its reputation terrible damage. And
damn you, Oliver.
Yeah, more than any other, you know. And yeah, with all that in mind, this is really successful in so many ways, I think, when you look at it. Sure, in the wider constructs of everything, no, it's not. Yeah, I suppose you can't really call it that in survival horror terms, maybe. But I think for Alone in the Dark and a series that deserves to get back on track to what it was in the first place, and a series that has long had an issue with its identity and finding it again, it's a success. And that's where we want to take this series going forward. So we've got the building blocks. There's a lot good here. Go at it again. New story, new stuff. Hone, you know, the stuff that you want to. And maybe, you know, just sort that combat out a bit. That's all.
Well, I have nothing to add to that because that was beautifully said. It's the type of thing where, you know, it was great to finally get our hands on it. And at the end of the day, it, I think, capitalized on the elements that we already liked about the original Alone in the Dark. It just seems like there are still some aspects of it that, you know, with a little bit more honing of focus and at the same time a little bit more money, maybe diverted from other features and whatnot, they'll be able to really tap into that with hopefully the next installment of Alone in the Dark. But that's going to do it for this week. But I am incredibly excited to say that next week we will be chatting about one of my all-time favorite games, that being Stalker Shadow of Chernobyl, which was recently ported to console for all you lucky console players out there that have never ventured into the zone. So that's going to be a really fun chat next week. But yeah, that's going to do it for our chat on the Alone in the Dark reboot. And as always, my friend, it's a pleasure chatting horror with you for Safe Room.
Back at you until we hit the wasteland next week.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Safe Room. If you enjoy the show, please rate us on iTunes and follow us on Twitter at Safe Room Pod for show updates. As always, our main episodes for Safe Room drop every Monday, but our bite-sized episodes of Horror Bites, our indie horror showcase, drop every Thursday. You can follow Horror Bites' Twitter account at horrorbites_SR. You can join our Discord channel, Safe Room Podcast, to chat with us and other horror fans about the genre we all love. And finally, you can send emails to saferoompod@gmail.com if you'd like to share your thoughts on a game we have or are going to cover. Thanks again for listening, and we'll see you guys next Monday.
Murder in America is a true crime podcast that covers stories from all 50 states, including stories of mass shootings, serial killers, and lesser-known murders. Do you find yourself doing more research after listening to a true crime show? Well, Courtney and I used to do the same thing, and that's why we created Murder in America. Our podcast dives deep into each case. Our storytelling will make you feel like you're right there within the case with us, watching it all play out, and we do not shy away from the graphic details. If you're a fan of true crime, then listen to Murder in America on Spotify now.
Every town has its dark history. Hometown Ghost Stories is a paranormal podcast that goes town to town all across the globe, exploring the world's most haunted places, tapping into the dusty archives and the darkest corners to bring you the most terrifying stories of real people and their harrowing experiences. Hometown Ghost Stories dives into the history of haunted locations and investigates why and how these places earned their terrifying reputation. Rob, Dave, and Jesse go live every Tuesday night after an uninterrupted documentary-style breakdown on the case, followed by an open discussion with live viewers. Subscribe today to listen to Hometown Ghost Stories on your preferred podcast platform, or watch the video version on YouTube and now Spotify. Head on over to the Bloody FM podcast network and check out Hometown Ghost Stories, if you're brave enough.